Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Starseed Radio Academy, empowering Starseed to better serve the planet.
Welcome to Starseed Radio Academy. It's Tuesday, December 6th, 2011, and I'm your host, Arielle Taylor, with my co-hosts, Lavendar and Sierra. Tonight, we're so pleased to welcome Dr. Carmen Bolter back to our show. She's the director, producer, and writer of the documentary miniseries, The Pyramid Code, which is based on her extensive work and research in Egypt. And she's also author of Angels and Archetypes, an evolutionary map of feminine consciousness. Dr. Carmen has just returned from her Magic Egypt tour, where she led a group for 11-11-11 and Pleiadian lineup. We'll be talking about that adventure tonight, as well as her upcoming books and one of her newest projects called InteractiveU.com. On 12-12-12, she's taking another group to Egypt, and we'll find out all about that as well. Her website is pyramidcode.com. We want to thank Purple Sage and Tammy for hosting the chat room and switchboard this evening. Purple Sage will forward your questions to us if you can't call. And if you can call, our number is 917-889-8292. Then press 1 so we know we have something to say. You can also listen on your computer at blogtalkradio.com/starseed-radio-academy. If you haven't yet, please click follow on our show page to help our show become more visible, and you'll be notified of our upcoming topics immediately. If you like the show, remember to tell a friend. After tonight's show, we'll be over the 68,000 listens mark, so thanks to all of you for tuning in each week and helping spread the word. On our main site, which is starseedhotline.com, we have a lot of vital information for Starseed in our Vault of Knowledge. The entire site is coded for Starseed activation, and we also have a support forum for Starseed at starseedhotline.ning.com. Plus, we're on iTunes if you'd like to download our shows to go. We'll get started with Lavendar and Dr. Carmen in just a minute, but first I'd like to let you know that if you want to contact us privately, the toll-free number for our website is 888-881-0881. Our Stage 1 Starseed confirmations are based on Lavendar's discovery of star markings and your natal astrological chart. And the Stage 2 session is a one-on-one phone consultation. You can find out if you have star markings and how they determine your natural state and rites of passage. We now offer a Stage 4 support service with Sierra for contactees and abductees, so check out Sierra's World on our main site. And don't forget, if you have a birthday coming up, you should know when your 10 hours of power will occur by requesting your solar return timing. Your manifestational ability is amplified a thousandfold during those 10 hours, so make the most of it. And now I would like to introduce my co-hosts, Lavendar and Sierra. Hello, ladies.
Hello, Lavendar here. I'm very excited to have Dr. Carmen tonight. Is Sierra with us?
Yes, I sure am. Hello.
Great. Is Dr. Carmen, is she on?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, let's
All right.
Let's go.
Okay, let me get her mic open. Okay, Dr. Carmen, welcome.
Hi.
We're so glad to have you back.
Thank you very much for wanting me back.
Well, we are really, really excited to hear all the news and all the adventures you've had since you were with us. I think it was last August you were with us. So, Lavendar, do you want to get the ball rolling?
Yes, I will. Oh, so glad to have you, Dr. Carmen, and I'm just anxious to hear what happened on this trip. So start at the very beginning and just kind of take us on a travelogue with your trip.
Okay, well, the first... I went to Berlin first and went to see Nefertiti, actually. And so I was really impressed with how many Egyptian artifacts are in the Berlin Museum, including the papyrus from the pyramid texts, which was really surprising. I was in there for 6 hours. And then I flew to Cairo, and the first thing I noticed was that there was no policemen, machine guns, or anything at the airport. And I went for a good long time in Egypt before I saw anybody with a gun, and then finally I saw the tourist police. But typically they had a lot of military rule over there. And so initially I was thinking that this is the new Egypt, and all the blockades that they had at the entrance to the Great Pyramid and all kinds of people there with guns were gone as well. And so all of that seemed like we were really in a freer version of Egypt. And we had our permit confirmed for the 11/11. And then a few hours before we were supposed to go into the pyramid, we learned that the military had shut it down. But because the energy was so strong and I could feel it, like, absolutely palpable from the hotel, sitting by the pool in view of the Great Pyramid, I could feel the energy was as strong as it was in years past when I had been inside the body of the Sphinx. So I was really impressed with the energy. So when I was told by the logistics person from the tour company that they had canceled all the permits for inside the Great Pyramid, I just actually laughed out loud and went, well, they can't shut the energy down. So it very much seemed like a formality, and they were claiming that there were rumors that there was a Zionist plot and that the Star of David was going to such and such and so and steal the pyramid from the Egyptian people. And all of this was rhetoric, basically. And I didn't think it mattered at all, actually. And so we were rescheduled to go in on 2011-2011, which I thought was also numerologically poetic. And the group was solid, and we ended up spending the night in the full moon light at the crystal altar of Abu Ghraib that I hadn't planned on going to because they've submitted exorbitant prices to go in there since the pyramid code came out. So it all worked out better than we could have ever planned it, and I'm telling you, the energy was very, very, very strong.
How many people were on your trip?
35, but inside the Great Pyramid when we went, there were 40 of us.
Okay. Okay, can you tell us some personal experiences that maybe others shared with you from the trip, things that happened to them?
Oh, well, there were people from 6 countries. There was an Italian woman who didn't speak English, and that was a bit of a trip. And this time I also had my family with me, so I had my 2 sisters and my cousin from New York, so that was fun. But when we went in around the Sphinx, we got to go into all the cavities in the inner chamber of the heart of the Sphinx, and there's wormhole passageways that are accessed through the left hind rump of the Sphinx, and also a passageway where there's been no restoration on the right front elbow of the Sphinx. And so that was pretty extraordinary. And it happened over and over again where we ended up alone. And so we were with our group privately inside all 3 chambers of the Great Pyramid, the pit, the Queen's Chamber, and the so-called King's Chamber. We had private time for 2 whole hours in the cavity of the Sphinx. And we even got to be there during the beginning of the Sound and Light show, so that was an incredible photo op. And then we were alone in the Holy of Holies at the Temple of Isis, and we got to go to the Temple of Kalabasha that was underneath the water after they let the water in the Aswan Dam go. And so they moved that 40 kilometers, and that was an extraordinary experience. So, you know, people really were able to go deep because we had such quiet, and it's not because Egypt was empty, because Egypt was actually filled with people, but no Westerners. Almost nobody from North America, England, or Australia were there, and I think that that has a lot to do with the media and, you know, the fear and the propaganda that's been going on about Egypt, Egypt, scary, scary, and they forgot to tell people in India, China, all over Asia, and all over South America that it was scary, and so actually, you know, there were a lot of places where Egypt was really full, shoulder to shoulder, in the museum. But somehow we ended up with an awful lot of magic, and we left really early to go on the long drive to the Temple of Abydos and the Temple of Dendera, and we were alone in both of those temples. And when we were finished and we were on our way out, then the crowds came. So really, as far as I'm concerned, the more time that you can spend alone in the temples, the better off we are. And we went to the Temple of Luxor at night, and so we ended up being alone there as well. So it just was one time after another where we were blessed with the pure energy. And my experience is that, you know, as soon as the pyramid clears or as soon as the temples clear, the energy resets and you start over again. And people's consciousness is expanded in the pyramid. So if you've got somebody that's, you know, chitter-chattering and an egoic state of mind, then that just magnifies. So to be there alone is really an incredible blessing.
Oh, that's great. Well, I had a couple of clients that were on your trip, and they had some Giza crystals that I had sent to them to take with them on the trip. Did you happen to experience anything with the Giza crystals?
Oh, yes. I saw them, and I know that they worked with them. I know that one of the women went into the inner chamber of the Heart of the Sphinx and put them in there, and they were powerful, and there was some interesting things going on with crystals all around. Yes, they were very, very strong, and they definitely were part of the rituals, including the night of 11-11-11 when we were in the moonlight at the crystal altar. So they definitely blended with the energies in a very powerful way.
Did you notice a lot of transformation of people, like the day that you first saw them on the first day and then on the last day, could you see how much their consciousness had raised while they were there?
Well, absolutely. And the case in point was within my own family. I've pretty much been estranged for my whole adult life from one of my sisters, and we hadn't talked, and I didn't even go to my father's funeral, to tell you the truth. And the second time we talked, after we kind of kissed and made up, she said, I want to come to Egypt. And so I thought, okay, let's just start a new page here. And we had an amazing healing when we were there, and everything was absolutely perfect. And by the end, you know, she hadn't even seen the pyramid code when she came, and she was like, what do you mean they're not tombs? And people said, aren't you Carmen's sister? You know? And it's like, oh, no, my DVD's been broken for a while, and no, I haven't seen the pyramid code. And so by the end of it, she was like, wow, I can really feel the energy. So I would say that that is an incredible transformation.
So. Absolutely. So tell us a little bit more about the pyramid codes. We have a lot of new listeners tonight, and they didn't hear your show from August. So just kind of recap and take us through the pyramid code.
The pyramid code is 5 episodes, and they're an hour long each. And it's basically cracking the code of what we haven't heard about what Egypt really is. And a lot of traditional Egyptology repeats a story that doesn't really add up to the idea that the ancients were starseed and that the pyramids were energy devices and multidimensional platforms, if you will, and the whole idea of consciousness being the highest value for the ancient Egyptians, and their focus on biology and cosmology, meaning in the simplest terms, they were interested in how do we get here and what happens when we transition out. And so the idea of a sky-ground correlation and archaeoastronomy, things being aligned, and a tremendous depth of the science that the ancient Egyptians were demonstrating that has been largely misinterpreted or ignored. And so it has 174 animations in it that's basically showing people bit by bit how this system could have worked and how it was a passive energy system, free energy, and what the Egyptians valued and how they lived in states of deep knowing. And we have departed so far from that, and we claim that we are the smartest, you know, that's ever been, and actually we're pretty dumbed down by comparison, and that's part of why it's been hard for us to see who the ancient Egyptians were. So the pyramid code is really about erasing the board and starting over again and looking at the evidence. And so there's an indigenous wisdom keeper named Hakim who has since passed, and he would say things like, it's not fair to deny what you can see and touch with your own hands. So the pyramid code isn't asking you to believe anything. It's basically showing things like a quartz crystal altar with a 6-foot radius of a laser-cut crystal. And definitely quartz crystal, although it's said that it's alabaster. It's really quartz. And all of these incredible high technology items that are technology from stone, but also definitely evidence of high technology, have not been noticed in Egypt. So it really is about coming up to date and reinterpreting what's there. And so most people don't realize that there are 6 sites and that the Giza Plateau has pyramid fields north and south, and that they're all correlated with planetary systems, the Pleiades, Cygnus, Sirius, Orion, and it goes on from there, and that this whole alignment aligns with the extragalactic grid and goes straight into the galactic center, which is where we're headed for 2012 on December 21st. So there's a lot there that people haven't known what to make of, and the Pyramid Code exposes truths that really do make sense once you've seen it.
Okay, and you know, I haven't talked to you before about this other book that you have written called Angels and Archetypes. Give us a little brief how you came to write and what you think will benefit those on Starseed Hotline that listen to our show to get this book.
Well, it's an evolutionary map of feminine consciousness. It's 22 goddesses, and their higher selves are angels. And it's a divination system. So it's an original set of runes, and the higher selves of the goddesses are these angelic messages, and it follows numerology, astrology, and tarot through the archetypal energy. So an archetype is something that exists whether you're conscious of it or not. And the Egyptians were very much, they demanded a balance between the masculine and the feminine. And basically our culture has kind of lopped off the feminine and focus on things that can be seen instead of things that are more symbolic and that can't be seen as well. And so it's a journey of self-awareness and consciousness that goes through the feminine aspects. And so I guess the psychological thing would be that if you're only following one archetype, let's say the Persephone daughter, who could be like a bulimic daughter, then that archetype can run a person instead of being more in balance. And if we avoid one, if we're pretty friendly with the other archetypes and avoid one, for example, Baba Yaga, who's the queen of the bad hair day, then we have to pay homage to that archetype. So really it's about getting to know ourselves and seeing the shadow sides of ourselves. And yet it's relevant to men as well, because men have feminine aspects. And that doesn't mean that they're gay, if you will, but it means that they're balanced within themselves. And so we've distorted a lot of the sacred knowledge. And it's also gone underground because most of us who have reincarnated have lived through the witch trials and all of that. And so really it's about understanding how consciousness works. And it's got secrets of goddesses from all around the world. 4 of them are Egyptian, 7 are Greek, and the rest are from around the world. So I started writing that. I spent 10 years researching it. It's got a 22-page bibliography, and it's looking for fragments from matriarchal cultures. And so the patriarchy's agenda has been to erase evidence of everything other than itself. And so a lot of the lost knowledge truly has been lost through burning sacred texts and through focusing in different ways. So it really was ahead of its time. It's increasing in popularity now that it's at the end of its run. But it's almost encyclopedic in its attempt to find the fragments from ancient cultures that speak to balance between the masculine and the feminine.
I'm noticing as I'm looking at this book, it's talking about the Hathors, and tell us who they were and are and their connection, maybe not so much to Earth but to sky.
Well, Hathor herself actually has been largely misunderstood as well, because she's like the universal goddess, the cosmic mother of us all, and she contains all the other goddesses. So in the monotheistic Christian cultures, we think about the one god who's masculine, who's, you know, got a thunderbolt and is going to strike us down. But Hathor was more the nurturing goddess. And the Hathors are considered to be a race of beings that are actually standing columnar waves that appear in pastel colors. And Tom Kenyon's done a lot of work with them, accessing them. And so they're highly spiritual beings that actually can assist us and connect with us, and they come from a dimensional frequency that's far beyond the earth plane. And most of the times when you see any of the Egyptian gods and goddesses, you'll see them in profile, and so it's almost like they're shown in two dimensions and they were walking on the earth in three dimensions. But when you see Hathor, she is full face, and you see her in three dimensions, which means she's beyond the fourth dimension. And so she's a magical being that has a lot of grace and a lot to offer us, and mostly she's been misunderstood. She's represented as a cow, with the cow ears, and the milk of human kindness, and the nurturing that comes through the milk of a cow. And so, again, a lot of the animalistic sorts of metaphors that go with Egyptian gods and goddesses are misunderstood by us, but to me they're more like animal totems, where they're bringing virtues and graces from the beyond.
Well, thank you. I think Lavender's having a little technical difficulty.
Sorry, I was talking and it was on mute. I'm sorry. Okay. My question is about the Hathors. Do you think they were more Pleiadian or from Sirius?
Not Sirius. Venus, actually.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't think they're Pleiadian either. I think they're from Venus and in the dimensions that go beyond that.
When someone says, well, I'm a Hathor woman, can you give us a description of what a Hathor woman might be in her earth suit?
Definitely full-bodied and... Hathor is the goddess of love and beauty, and of dance and of joy and of fully living within the pleasures of the earth, if you will. And so full spectrum senses and highly aware, highly tuned, very sophisticated.
Well, I think we have a lot of Hathor women that are in our inner circle, as I'm looking at the description of the Hathor's woman. So, Ariel, do you have any questions for Carmen?
Well, I just think it was wonderful, as you said, magical, that you got to spend private time. It's almost, like having... having the I'm seeing like the sea parting and all the tourists go away and having that private time in the pyramid. Is there sound? I mean, how does the sound travel in those structures? Does it have an unusual quality to it?
Yes. Now, you know, when we get to go into the Great Pyramid and we're alone and all three chambers are open, people walk in and they kind of go, oh, yeah, well, I guess that's kind of normal. But most people don't realize how extraordinary it is to get private time, whether you're willing to pay for it or not. Like, you do have to pay for the permits. But it's quite rare. And most of the time it's just one chamber that's open and then they rush you in and rush you out. So, you know, in the olden days you couldn't spend more than 10 minutes in there and there'd be 100 other people with you. So the thing about the pyramids and the Great Pyramids, one of them, and Dahshur is another resonance chamber. They're all resonance chambers, but there's different shaped chambers inside each one, and then the angle of the outside of the pyramid is also different. And so it could be only different by one or half a degree or 1 degree, and the placement of the chambers are different, and there's also hollow stones in between on the floor and that sort of thing. And so what most people don't realize is that every single thing inside the Great Pyramid is magnified, from a thought to a sound. And so it can be absolutely thunderous to have like 30 people all walking up and down the passageways, and it just booms right inside my head. So I always give instructions to people to be incredibly respectful in there and not to speak, to see it as a temple of sound as well. And so we kind of rushed in and got situated in one of the three chambers and then went quiet. And then we started to tone. So even the softest little tone just booms and magnifies. And one of the things that Tom Kenyon does when he's working with the Hathors is he makes these different sounds. And I was at a conference that he gave one time, and we all went into meditation, and he started to tone. And then it sounded to me like, wait a minute, that sounds like there's a flute. I'm hearing a drum. I'm hearing all these different instruments. I'm hearing more than one person singing. But when I closed my eyes, it was just him up there on the stage. So I found myself opening my eyes, and he was up there alone. And the Tibetans do this as well, where they make different shapes with the cavity of their mouth and open their lungs and push the diaphragm in various places. And so there's a way that you can change how you sound. And then that sound blends with someone else's sound, but it also blends within the chamber. And it reaches these resonant frequencies. And so there was someone who went into the sarcophagus of the king's chamber and was laying there and was toning. And there were other tones in the other chambers. And he had this incredible experience where he felt he achieved resonance. And he was completely transformed when he came out of there, because there was something about the vibrational frequency of the sound that somehow then affected his physical body at the cellular level. So then we took that and went into the cavities of the Sphinx, and so that was quite profound for him. So it has to do with the shape of the corbelled roof in the Grand Gallery. It has to do with the acoustics within the pyramid, with the different kinds of stone, with the crystal matrix of the granite in there. And it's difficult to describe without experiencing it, but it certainly goes beyond the physical. And for me, what I experience is, I call it space between my cells. But what fills that space is what I say is the substance that psychicness is made of. And so this is not vocabulary that we tend to use or constructs that are loosely discussed. But I've had to make sense of this over the 26 trips to Egypt and understand how we can actually get imprinted somehow, that the tone and the resonance field actually does something to the physical body. Now, if you think about the temples in Egypt, that the shape of the temples, you actually enter the temple through, if you were superimposing a human body over the temple, you enter through the feet, and the Holy of Holies is the pineal gland, which is the super spiritual conductor that almost looks like a pine cone. And the cavities of the human body are the hypostyle halls. And the populace, the general populace, may be able to get into the first hypostyle hall down by the feet, but they wouldn't be able to have the consciousness or the initiate training to get all the way up into where just the high priest and the high priestess and perhaps the pharaoh and queen would go. And so all of this is about understanding how there's sacred geometry in the body, there's sacred geometry in nature, and in the ancient language, the pyramid is called Per Neter, which is the house of nature, which means on some level it's magnifying all of the properties and the physics of nature. And that is how, that's what it's representing, and that's what it's doing. So it's beyond our comprehension. But to have a pure experience in there, and to even experience just silence in there, it's incredible, because it's not quiet. There's you can hear the music of the spheres, and there's a lot going on in there.
Yeah, I can just almost through your words, you described it so beautifully. Just imagine, like being inside the pyramid on a very grand scale. Be like being inside the seashell, where you can be part of that ocean sound, and you're part of the inherent sound of the pyramid, because sound is frequency vibration, and certainly the pyramid is generating a lot of energy which has frequency, and I can easily see how that would affect you on a cellular level. And also, I mean, wouldn't the stones hold vibrations from previous visitors, or like you said, when they close the doors at night, does it just reset itself, and anything that's ever happened to the pyramid is no longer vibrating there?
Well, that remains to be seen, but because people have become irreverent is a word that I use. When people get in there and go, oh, take a picture of me, I'm here, look at me, look at me, you know, and I'm like, what? That's just so much from the ego and the silliness of people's thoughts and the shallowness with which they approach the pyramids, just like a tourist attraction sort of thing, to me damages the energy in there. So I think if it sets and clears, that's probably a good thing. I'm not sure how much stays in there. I suppose that's a question to be debated. But I definitely like your metaphor of being inside a seashell, and I think that that's the sort of thing. It's generating a sound. Like, how can you hear the ocean in a shell? And it is like a life, a larger than life size version of that. I think that if the pyramid and the temples reset, that's a good thing. And that's mm-hmm. definitely my experiences. And it's happening faster, too. That, I had an experience at the Temple of Isis, and there's a shrine to Hathor there. And I went in there, and I was by myself, and I felt like, oh, my God, it just goes so silent and pure so instantly. And somebody from our group came in, and the energy stayed the same. And then it was just the two of us. And then somebody from another group came in, and I felt like they were walking through my head, if you will, like they were a foreign object, and it changed the vibration. And they left, and then a few other people from our group came, and that was a unified field. And I thought, wow, it's from all these 26 trips and the amount of time that I spent in all these temples, it just seems like the energy is magnified somehow and reacting faster and stronger in some way. Which also means, I think, that if you're off or if you're in your ego, then that's kind of bouncing around and magnifying as well. You know what I mean? So if somebody's mm-hmm. not in a pure state, that's why I insist that we go in there alone. I cannot possibly tolerate being in there with just the average public just kind of chit-chattering away. It makes my head feel like it's going to blow up. So I think it's really, really important that we respect the energy and work with it. And I think that what's happening now as we go through these ascension portals is that it's magnifying, you know, to the point where, as I mentioned, that you could feel it, you know, at the hotel by the pool in the shadow of the pyramid. Like, I was astounded at how strong the energy was at a distance.
And it seemed stronger than you had perceived it in previous trips?
Oh, yeah, and I'm very familiar with this energy. I've lived over in Egypt, and I spent years just in and out of the cavities and the passageways underneath the plateau, and I spent, you know, 3.5 hours in the pit by myself in the dark, and I'm familiar with this energy. And any time I had been inside the body of the Sphinx, I wouldn't sleep for 72 hours. Like, that's something you don't forget, because, I mean, how do you go for 3 days and three nights without sleeping? And so this time when I went there, I could feel that level of energy out just at the hotel. And so it's incredibly magnified, which is why when the military shut down our permit for the 24 hours and nobody got in, no matter what anybody tells you, no one got in the pyramid for those 24 hours, and there are people who are claiming that they were there, and that's not so. No one got in the pyramid. The keys were at the office in Zamaliek, at the Supreme Council of Antiquities, and it was locked. There were the other pyramids people got in, but nobody got in the Great Pyramid. But the fact that they closed it, to me, the whole band of peace is a unified field. And to me, if we were in a reverent space and close to the crystal altar, for example, that was every bit as powerful, honestly, as being inside the Great Pyramid. The energy is supremely magnified now.
Do you think
I have a question for you, Dr. Carmen? Tell us a little bit. How was the food on this trip?
Well, one of the things is no one got sick for the first time, and in all these groups that I've led, and I was going over there as many times as four times a year, so I've led a good number of groups, and there usually was somebody with funny tummy, as I call it, and this time everybody was solid as a rock, so the whole group moved as a unit. So the food was spectacular. It was amazing, absolutely amazing. I mean, they've made lots of changes and improved things for us, and I was delighted with how it was. It was very, very good.
What hotel were you staying at?
We were at the Meridian in by the pyramids, but then we were at the King's Island at the Maritim Jellyville outside Luxor, and then we were on the Mirage cruise, and then we were at the Eber Hotel in Aswan, and then we came back to the Meridian. Next time, though, I'm looking into us staying at Mena House.
I stayed at the Mena House. I loved it, and of course it burned, and I think they rebuilt it or did some reconstruction work. My next question is about, we were seeing here on television the riots that were starting to happen just about the time you were getting ready to leave. Can you give us a little insight on what you saw?
Well, yes, we saw nothing, and somebody had to go online to learn that there was something going on. So we had a 180-degree view of the Nile. Everybody was on top of their game. We were thinking we're in the lap of luxury. Wow, isn't this great? And then somebody says, hey, there's riots. And we went, well, certainly doesn't look like it here. Now, and this was true when we got back to Cairo as well and to Giza. Like, there was nothing to perceive. And this is CNN mentality, and as I mentioned, there were no North Americans in Egypt that I could see, certainly just a handful of them, if any, and our group. And that's because we keep getting told to be afraid. So CNN finds a little something. Tahrir Square is where the people were isolated in their protest. Yes, there were some fires. Yes, some tear gas, you know, interaction between the conflict between the military and some protesters. But one of the things about what happened before in Egypt getting Mubarak out was what the people said was that the revolution wasn't complete. That, you know, you can't just leave the military there. They were going to prevent the election from happening. And so the real change has to be in stages. And I think that the protests are pushing that along and making sure it happens. But the way CNN globalizes everything and forgets to talk about the human interest stories and the good things that are happening and the empowerment of people and how pleased they were with what was going on in Egypt, they make it look terrible. And so, I mean, I got 47 emails the day after the protest started. Oh, do you have bullet holes in you? And, oh, is there fire right beside you? Well, no, there's peace and beauty beside me. And the other thing is that before we left, there was a little bit of a kerfluffle around October 10th, which happened to be the day that the last time we'd been in the pyramid. And everybody's like, oh, you know, it's a big danger, big danger. And I'm like, I'm going. I don't care. I mean, for 26 trips, 26 on 26, somebody's saying, oh, you should be afraid. I was watching TV, and Egypt is really scary. No, Egypt's one of the safest places I've ever been. I feel afraid when I'm in the States. I mean, to me, the energy is And the weekend after this 10-10 kerfluffle, there were protests in 1,500 cities, okay, with tear gas and everything else and people getting arrested. And so I'm telling you, it's isolated to Tahrir Square. The people, the average person does not agree and does not go down there to protest. And that's what has to happen for the change to occur, or else they're going to slip right back into where they were before. And so it is really important that we see through this. Now, I don't watch TV and I won't watch the news because it breaks my heart to see the way they present things. But I happened to have got, you know, there was fog and the plane was late and I got bumped and I ended up having to stay overnight in Zurich. So here it was, me and the flat screen TV, and so I turned it on. And at first I was like, oh, come on, there, you know, the way that they show it. And they just take a fragment of something and blow it up and make it look worse, but then they repeat and repeat and repeat and repeat. And by the end, you know, a couple hours into it, I'm like, well, maybe there is danger. I mean, you can't keep showing that and exposing your psyche to something without starting to believe it. You know what I'm saying? And so really Egypt was in fabulous shape. I thought it was great. We got to do things we haven't done before in the post-Zahi Hawass era. I felt like people were very grounded and very kind and, you know, like they were wearing their hearts on their sleeve as they always do. The Egyptian people are the nicest, kindest, sweetest people. And so to make the whole world afraid, well, not the whole world, all of the Western world afraid, to me is its own kind of crime against humanity. It really is a distortion of what's going on there. And no matter what happens, I'm going for 12-12. You know what I'm saying? It's like I don't care what kind of scenario they try to drum up. I think it's really important to stay close to the monuments and to be in the energy field. And you can't shut down the galactic alignment or the energy that's coming. And it is more intense when you're there. And I think it's very important to show up. And coming back, you know, I realized just how dense it is here. It's difficult to come back. And Lord knows I've had enough practice coming back. And I always feel like I'm kind of sleeping under a bed of rocks or something, you know, that I feel so everything is so heavy and dense here by comparison. So I think it's good to experience that and to feel the levity and the quickness of the spiritual energy. I think it's palpable and it's important to integrate it.
Well, I just wish that a lot of people could maybe make this next trip to 12-12 with you. How many people are you going to try to take on 12-12?
Oh, it's going to be a big group. Like this isn't going to be a small thing at all. It's at least 100 people.
Wow, that would be pretty awesome. So,
yeah,
Ariel, would you like to open up the switchboard and the chat room and see if we have any questions?
Well, I will in just a moment. So that's heads up to Purple Sage. I'll be coming to you next. I wanted to know if you had any, because you were there for Pleiadian lineup.
Yes.
Did you see any ships? Did you have any ET or anyone in your group have ET contact or high strangeness over Pleiadian lineup in Egypt?
Uh-huh. there was some really, really, really interesting stuff that happened. And, of course, everyone wasn't able to perceive it, and that's normal. That's fine. I guess I forget that everybody isn't perceiving on the same levels. But one of the things that happened for me that just absolutely is mind-boggling, and it's happened to me. Things like this have happened before, but pure manifestation. And so spirit has done things like this before, and they try to find a way to connect something out of in the physical. So I met a crystal that I'd never seen before manifested. It actually was like I usually take my iPad charging cord and fold it in four and then tie it in a knot and put it in a little pouch. And so if spirit was trying to get my attention, that would be the place to put it, my iPad charging cord. And so here was this crystal embedded in there. And, of course, first when I saw it, I was just like, somebody came in the room and put it there? No, right? The private room. No one's been in my suitcase. Anyway, so this thing had so much energy on it, I couldn't get over it. And it's spooky when stuff like that happens. Anyway, so I took it with me to the 11-11 thing, and I was laying on the crystal altar. And so I took it because it was flat on the bottom, and I put it on my third eye. And then I went tripping away and had just an amazing, amazing experience. And then I put my hand on my forehead to, you know, take it off and put it back in my pocket, and I couldn't feel it. And then I kind of felt all the way around my head, and I couldn't feel it. And then I sat up, and it was gone. And I thought, oh, it went right back where it came from. You know, things like that. And then there was someone who perceived a pentagram superimposed on the moon, and it was in another dimension. There's no question about that. And then there was a couple that had a Star Walk application on their iPhone, and they were holding it up and looking at these at different constellations in the sky. Again, it was pretty clear. The sky was pretty clear at night, and they saw an anomaly behind the moon, and so they were up all night trying to decide what it was because, again, they were... Like everybody who saw this stuff was freaked out, and they all came to me and went, I saw something. I'm not really sure what to make of it. And so they were convinced that the moon was hiding a portal that was behind it, and that had they not positioned the portal behind the moon, that it would have just been exposed for everyone to see, and so that was a bit of a camouflage. Now, there was some stuff about spaceships and whatnot, but it did not corroborate. Like, there was a group that was saying that they saw a ship outside the Great Pyramid. There was somebody who had posted on YouTube on the 12th of November, but it hadn't been filmed then. So I'm always debunking to try to make sure that, you know, this footage is from when they say. And this other group who claimed that everyone in their group saw a ship, it wasn't at the pyramids, it was at the Temple of Queen Hatshepsut, and I've yet to see those pictures. But for sure, there was interaction with beings from the other side. I could hear them speaking, I could feel them, and I didn't see a ship this time. But definitely communication from the other world, unquestionable.
And when you were actually in the pyramid, there has got to be a lot of other dimensional beings, regardless of where they came from. Were you aware or in contact with non-corporeal beings inside, or aware that they were either, you know, energies of some kind?
Yes, and for sure our pictures were loaded with orbs, and more than just orbs, like orbs that have rainbows in them and very large and very bright, and also different apparitions and different colors. And yes, there was a woman there, and she just had the wildest pictures that were way, way beyond orbs, and not just her. I mean, there was a lot of that. But for me, when I was toning ever so softly in the Great Pyramid, I mean, I had to keep, I felt spooked by it in a way again, because it was almost like I was hearing more than just me, but there wasn't anybody else who was toning. And so I kept on kind of jumping back and forth and trying to decide if that can't be just me. Well, I mean, we know that with somebody else's is singing beside us, that there's two voices, not one, or three, or four, depending on how many people are there. And yet, there wasn't anybody else opening their mouth in that chamber at the time. So, yes, it's hard to describe these sorts of things, but I was convinced that I was hearing something that was from the other side, more than once. Like Hakim, for example. Like, he passed. And the one that's in the Pyramid Code, the Indigenous Wisdom Keeper. Well, when this whole thing started to come down about the permit wasn't going to happen, like I learned about it in the afternoon, and I wasn't sure how I was going to present it and what we could do, because, you know, people go straight into their egos and freak out because, oh, I paid for this, and oh, it's supposed to happen. Well, the military shut us down, and there's, you don't know that it isn't going to turn out better. Like, I wasn't flustered at all about it, but I did need to make a plan. Well, I felt him coming and talking to me. Next, his son appears. Next, his son's got a way to get us to another place. Poof, 11 taxis. Poof, you know, the watchmen are all on side. Poof, they let us all do it all. And then there's Hakim, I felt like his face was right in front of my face, and he's talking to me. Well, then, you know, his son, we went to Abu Sir, and he started, like, I've known his son since he's like 14 years old, and he never took an interest in these sacred sites or any of this. You know, he was a dutiful son who would serve tea and, you know, that sort of thing. But he didn't seem to be remotely interested in this material. And all of a sudden, there he is, blah, 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 and this in the PowerPoint, and this in the power plant, and how the water and the system and all this works. And I went up to him after, and I said, tell me, did you say more than you know today? And he went, yeah, like, you know, that's been happening to me. It's like, so I said, well, you realize what's going on here? And he says, well, I kind of suspect. And I said, well, you're channeling your father. And he goes, well, I know, but it's even more than Hakim knew. Like, I spent 10 years learning from Hakim. And he took me to these sites, and he told me what he knew. And so there, it's, so now Hakim, I think, has an even greater perspective on the other side. And he's speaking to us and through us, which is mind-boggling, really, don't you think?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, especially that now that he's on the other side and his son is opening up. You know,
it's amazing.
He carries the bloodline.
He does, and it's amazing. And so in some ways, you know, to have that kind of, to me, direct contact, I mean, I'm talking, it feels like, you know, they're touching in the flesh sort of thing. And, you know, so what's the ship? I mean, even looking at the photographs on the front page of my website that's connected to photos with that Holy Grail of the Sacred Feminine, I mean, you know, what is that? I mean, that's a plasma being, that's a spinning energy, like, you know, does it have to be a ship? I mean, if it's a, you know what I mean? Like, I think we expect that, you know, a ship's going to come along like a car or an airplane and park, and, you know, we make up what that kind of thing is supposed to look like, but it can come in many forms, and it's almost like, you know, passing between the dimensions, you don't need the vehicle in the same way.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, it's almost like you can feel it, but it's not as direct. I don't know. It's difficult to speak about this. We don't really have the vocabulary for it, do we?
No, but I understand what you're saying. Well, let me check in with our chat room host, Miss Purple Sage, as soon as I find her on the switchboard here. And we do have a lot of people on the switchboard tonight, and I'm sure they're just enwrapped with your story. And we're going to try to get to everybody, so be patient. Okay, Purple Sage, you're on the air. So how is it in the chat room tonight? Hi, everybody.
Oh, we're loving it. We're loving it. Hello, Dr. Coulter.
Hi.
Hi. I do have three questions from the chat room, and then I got a gazillion. So we'll see how the time goes.
Okay.
One person wants to know, what do you have to say to sum up Sophia?
Who?
Sophia.
What did you say, sum it before?
No, what do you have to say about Sophia?
Gaia Sophia, like the planet?
I'm taking it that's what they meant.
Say to her?
About, no, about her.
Okay. I think that we're in a corridor of co-creativity with Gaia Sophia, and that the so-called end of the Mayan calendar, a la Carl Kalaman, October 28th, and yet the galactic alignment is until December 21st, is a corridor of co-creation. And when they switched out the cultural myth to make a male, old god with the thunderbolt that was going to strike us down, we're supposed to have faith in him. But actually, that really damaged us and the collective unconscious, because in truth, Gaia Sophia has faith in us, and that this story hasn't been written. It's hard to psychically know what's going to happen, because we're co-creating it with her. And so Gaia is the 22nd goddess in my book, and basically it's the entirety of the consciousness of the planet, and it's nature. And so per nature, the house of nature is what the pyramid is, and so it's a model for the whole of the earth and the whole of the place of the earth within the galaxy, within the cosmos. And so to tune into this energy is essential. And it's the way through, and to create what we want rather than, or to co-create with her rather than succumb to fear, is the lesson, because fear takes us away and co-creativity helps us create. So we've got a choice. We either co-create with Gaia Sophia, or we move away from that and contract in fear. So I think the choice is obvious.
Yep, that's nice. Okay, Dr. Coulter, could you please talk about your experience of expansion, separation of cells, and a little more? The person who is asking this has had an experience something like this with a yoga instructor in a large group, and they want to know, have you experienced that before or after your trip? And can you suggest how this can happen for people?
I've definitely felt it before, as I mentioned. It particularly was the most acute when I was inside the body of the Sphinx by myself. And the minute that there's somebody else there, even a watchman, their consciousness gets mixed up in it. And so the purity of that energy is kind of what stirs me at the cellular level. I have to say that of all the sacred sites I've been to and all my experiences in nature and here in Canada, nothing compares to the experience around the Band of Peace and inside the Sphinx and the way the energy was now. The sense of expansion and space between the cells is kind of almost like taking a deep, that sense of awe when you get to the top of a mountain or something, and that gasping and air coming in and creating space. How to experience that more, I think that's a really personal thing. I think everybody's got to follow their passion and where they feel the most enlivened, if you will. And I've been passionate about Egypt since I was a little girl, so for me that's what triggers me. And I definitely feel it more when I'm in Egypt, and even though I carry as much of it back as I can here, I don't feel as good here as I do there.
Right. I understand that. excuse me. Somebody is interested in knowing more about our 360 senses that was mentioned in the Pyramid Code.
So I think of that as a complete sphere, almost like standing inside the sphere itself. And so there are cross points, like if you were to stand inside like a globe that has latitudes and longitudes, there are various nodes and cross points. And to me, that's where certain spirit beings can rest, like with spirit guides. Like for me, they take on a position, and I know it's them because of the color.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they have to densify a little bit, and we have to refine ourselves a little bit in order to be able to see them. But the senses, it's almost like handles between the chakras, and synesthesia, where you can see a picture or hear music, and children, infants can do this. And so it's almost like a blending of the senses, or the brain within our gut, if you will, and the way that we can know with our heart. And the ancient Egyptians were really well versed in this sort of thing of finding deep knowing at the cellular level. And so 360 senses, kind of it's like an owl that can turn their head all the way around 180 degrees each way. And this is 360, it's like we're turning around every which way. And so it's full spectrum awareness all of the time in our baby toe kind of thing. It's everywhere all at the same time. And that is something that we cultivate, and it's very much something like a muscle that we have to develop, and we also have to know how to perceive it. And it's almost like it's in diffuse awareness rather than focused attention.
Wow. Okay. Thank you for that answer. For myself, I think it's fascinating that you're finding there's layers of symbols and messages that fit the era of their creation, the symbols creation, and in particular the Abydos temple, where a chunk of the stone fell off. I know that you have marked a helicopter and an airship, but I clearly see also a modern day yacht right there in that circle of them. And my question is, have you spoken to the modern day tour guides who have been instructed not to point these areas out to tourists? And I know that the reason they've been told not to point them out is because it's just multiple scenes overlapping, which clearly it isn't if you look at the pictures. I'm wondering, have you talked to them? And because when you work so closely every day in this environment, you have some personal inter-radar that kicks up. And I'm just wondering if anybody has mentioned anything like that to you.
So the way it works in Egypt, Egyptologists have to memorize scripts, and they talk mostly about the later dynasties and Ramses and warring and cutting off the hands of his enemy and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not really sensitive to earlier stages or the matriarchal aspects of Egypt. And so it's very patriarchal, and if you can't see it, it's not there. And they want to see the script that says, even though it's quite arbitrary the way hieroglyphic is interpreted. And so they're very much of the mindset that they're right and nobody else knows anything. And to find someone who's actually curious, I mean, they're basically rule machines, like most people are here too, right? They want to enforce the rules and, no, you're not allowed to do that, and
right,
you're not allowed to say so, and they consider themselves to have a certain amount of status if they can shut you down and tell you not to speak. No, madame, you're not allowed to say that, right? And so to have somebody actually have time to interface or be able to understand is actually quite rare. A lot of the watchmen who have sat there and who don't really speak English, who have been at these sites for years and years and years, are really cosmic beings, and they're highly intuitive and psychic, and they sit there quietly, literally guarding and watching, and they recognize me when I come back. You know, and they don't say very much in English, but they'll say welcome back, or they'll just mm-hmm. look at me, and I'll know that they do recognize me. And so there isn't that much interaction, though, over trips when I have to have a guide with me and I pay them to be silent guides. You know, they'll start to listen a little bit and get a little excited and then do research in between trips and, you know, come back. And but it's very rare. It's very, very rare to find somebody who actually can be conversant in
okay.
a new way. I think that they turn a blind eye and don't stop you from pointing out. But it's difficult to see. Like, even though people have seen the Pyramid Code and they're looking for that lintel, and we go in there and I say, okay, everybody go and stand on this side. Okay, look up and beside this. Da, da, da. People are like, where? Where? What do you mean? What?
Mm-hmm.
And so with the animations in the Pyramid Code, we trace it. But it's right in front of you, right?
Right.
In high definition,
right.
And there's nothing else to look at. But a lot of what is significant in Egypt is hidden in plain sight. And many people don't have the eyes to see it or the ears to hear it, particularly if they're trained in a certain tradition. And so, no, there isn't that much interaction where people get it.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, thank you. You had also before mentioned the Temple of Isis, but with 85% of Egypt not excavated around the pyramids, yet they have sealed the Temple of Isis with concrete. Do you think that it's because there's information in that temple that the authorities in charge do not want to be revealed?
Okay, now, this is a question that many, many people have, and I want to clarify that there is a Temple of Isis in Aswan that was moved, and that's on the island of Philae, but there was also a Temple of Isis below and to the left of the Sphinx. That's what was cemented over. I have old pictures of it. Now, I think that, okay, in the same way that the pyramid was shut down because of a Zionist plot and they don't want the pyramid to be stolen from the people. I mean, all of this is rhetoric. They don't really know what they mean by that. A lot of people suspect that Zahi knows what he was hiding. I think they just cemented over just for the sake of, you know, let's put a road there. I don't know if they know what they're hiding. A lot of people say, oh, yeah, they've been into the Hall of Records and they've taken all the stuff and with an English book and a spaceship and there's stuff down there and Zahi's hiding it. Well, I spent a lot of time with Zahi, and I just think that people end up locked in a certain consciousness, and they want to be right, and they want to be the guy who's on top of things, and you can't know because you're a woman. You know what I mean? Like,
mm-hmm.
with that density of consciousness, I don't think that there's enough refinement to even understand that there could have been something subtle. They're not speaking the language of subtle. So do they know what they're hiding? No. Are they hiding it anyway, hiding it by cementing over the top? I think they're just being guys.
Okay. Okay. There are more questions, but Arielle, if you want to go ahead and go to
the switchboard,
that's okay.
Yeah.
I do want to
come back.
Yep, I do want to say there is one person from the chat room who did call in via Skype, and they have been pressing 1, and it's not showing up on the switchboard, so I did make a note there. And they
right.
want to talk about the King's... Oh, Tammy
right,
got it.
That.
Never mind.
I got that.
Okay.
Yeah, Tammy's on it. Yeah, the lady behind the curtain there. Yeah, we will. We have several callers that are waiting to speak with Dr. Carmen. And we're going to get to that, and then I'll come back to the chat room after that. So let's just move on. Thank you so much, Purple Sage.
Mm-hmm.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay. We're going to go next to Gabrielle because she was on the trip with you.
Hey, Gabby.
Hey, how are you, Carmen?
Good. How are you?
I'm pretty good. Well, I just thought I'd share my little experience I had in the little pyramid on 11/11 since we didn't get to go to the big one. And I don't think you were there, so you may not know. When I was privileged to go there on that day, just a few of us, as you mentioned, I got a release and a knowing that I had been there, that I, even now, thinking about it, the energy and the feeling and the emotion come up again. Sitting in there and meditating for 20 minutes with the toning was the most incredible experience that I've ever had. And then as I was trying, then of course the guards got crazy. About 20 minutes after toning, they kicked us out. So trying to leave, I had another release. And just to experience that was worth the trip for me, so... That was my little story that I wanted to share with everybody because I thought it's important that if you have a feeling that you want to go, you should go. There's something there for you.
Good to hear your voice.
Hey. I have it back anyway.
How's your reentry?
It was a little rough. It took me probably... I took today off again because I'm just not adjusting very well.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, there's a lot of synthesizing to do, and I think it's even rougher nowadays because the energy just hasn't caught up here.
Yeah. And I live in my own little world when I'm home, but it's still really rough for me. I did not believe it would be that rough. I've traveled overseas many, many times before, and coming back here was never hard. This is the hardest it's ever been for me.
And to me, what that says is that we really experience some incredibly refined energy, and there's no place to put that here yet.
Yeah, I have that feeling. I agree. So
I just
thought I'd tell you about that and everybody else. And I have a special message for Lavendar. She gave me a reading in April, and she told me to let her know when I call in my power. And I did while I was in Egypt. So there you go, Lavendar. I called in all my power.
Well, that's great. That's great. Gabrielle, thank you so much for sharing this experience. And you will have your work cut out for you finding the balance, finding the balance between, your old residence and your new energy.
Yeah, it's definitely working its way through me, and I can feel it in all ways. When I was in Egypt, I didn't have any kind of aches or pains except a little bit of muscles from walking the inclines. And coming back, my back's a little sore. I have a little pain here. I have a little ache there. And I'm normally pretty healthy, so it's unusual for me. And I'm like, oh, this is going through me physically.
Mm.
But you know what, Gabby, hearing your voice, I'm feeling excited and I'm feeling like we're kind of returned back to the energy of the trip for a moment, I'm feeling
I can feel that with you. I felt that as you were talking, so
yeah.
I've been online the whole time to listen, so
Yeah, it's really exciting to hear your voice. Good.
Yeah, me too. It was really a nice trip. Thanks.
Thank you.
Okay, Gabrielle, thank you so much for coming on and sharing with us. And, I hope you enjoy the show. We're going to move on.
Yep, I'll be in touch.
Okay.
Talk to you later.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, we are going to talk to Dante. He wants to discuss the King's Chamber. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello, hello.
Hello.
Yes. Actually, Carmen, you gave me the courage to call in. The reason being, because you mentioned that since childhood you had a set of memories about Egypt. Now, I've never been to Egypt, and similarly, since childhood, I had very vivid memories that I didn't really understand as a child. It was only later on that I gradually understood what they were about, and if possible, I'd like to share them with you.
Uh-huh.
It's specifically regarding the King's Chamber, actually. As a child, I recall bending down to go into this room. The room was illuminated by firelight. In the middle of the room was a stone kind of table. And my memory is as follows. I recall lying on the table. I had a guide with me at the time who after a while left me. But one of the questions I asked him was, how many have gone before me? So this made me think that perhaps I may have been some kind of an initiate or something. So the memory is that I'm lying on the table and the guide leaves me, and then all of a sudden I can only describe this as the chamber becomes active. And then although the King's Chamber, as you know, is blank, I recall hieroglyphs appearing in this kind of golden hue.
Mm-hmm.
And something happens, and I'm propelled out of the King's Chamber and just directly upwards. And my last thoughts was, as I'm being propelled upwards, I look behind me and I say, oh, that's clever, as above, so below. And that's my last kind of recollection of it. So my question to you would be, just me based on that memory makes me think of the hypothesis that King's Chamber, that pyramid is in fact a stargate, or part of its purpose is a stargate. Has anyone ever mentioned that to you before? Have you heard that before?
Absolutely, sure. Now, it sounds to me like a composite image, like that, because there's no table in the King's Chamber, and we don't even know if that's the right word name for it. That's why I say so-called King's Chamber. There probably wasn't fire in there, otherwise there would have been evidence of soot and charring, but it could be a luminous light. There's never been any decoration inside the Great Pyramid. It would be kind of like decorating the inside of your oven or the inside of the drain, because it actually is a machine. But there are energetic, hieroglyphic symbols that are alive, that appear luminous, in a luminosity that would have been part of the initiation. So, you know, people ask about the capstone on the Great Pyramid, and it could have been there in reality and then gone into the etherics. But the ancient Egyptians were popping between realities, and so all of this could have been going on in that general area, possibly even in chambers underneath the pyramid, in the passageways between the pyramids underneath. There's honeycomb passageways, and there were various rooms that would flood when the Nile was there, because the Nile has migrated eight miles now to the east. So all of this makes sense to me and sounds like an initiate would have experienced, but it wouldn't have all been within this dense third-dimensional reality. That's the point. You know what I'm saying? It's between the dimensions.
Yes, I'm going to share something with you. I felt as though I'd actually passed on and that this was in between lives.
Okay.
I don't know if that makes any difference, but yeah, the hieroglyphs, they weren't there to start with. It was only after the chamber became alive that they appeared.
Okay, so what the Egyptians were practicing was passing, and they didn't have a word for death, even though, you know, read 100 books on Egypt and they'll use the word death, because we use that word. And then, you know, we've outlawed reincarnation, the Council of Nicene, 323 AD, Emperor Constantine. Well, that's also not real to the ancient Egyptians. So we have to kind of climb our way back conceptually through you know, what were they really aware of? And they would practice moving between these states of consciousness so that when they actually passed and dropped the clothing of the physical body, they'd go, okay. And Anubis would meet you and say, you're dead. And you'd say, oh, really? I feel the same. And they'd say, well, check it out. There's your body. Now you're living inside your ba, which is the soul part, the part that never dies. And this is the part that Hakim was really good at. So when he passed, I knew within a nanosecond that he had passed. And then I got an email 15 minutes later, and he came right, he was right there in front of me the minute he passed, and then he'd come and talk to me. So because he understood this so well, he was really well-versed in moving between those dimensions, and I think you were too.
Yeah, that's the impression I get, actually, that I felt like it was, the initiation was partially to help me strip away a layer of physicality or something along those lines to enter this higher vibratory state, if you like. But yeah, it's an interesting memory, and that's why I've always had an affinity with the King's Chamber, because I've always thought it bizarre that it's completely blank, and yet it's the powerhouse, it's the pièce de résistance of the pyramid, if you know what I mean. It's always fascinated me.
Wonderful. Thank you for sharing.
Thank you.
Okay, people. We are having a little bit of technical difficulty. Ariel, can you hear us?
Oh, yes, I can. I'm sorry. I keep my mute button on when other people are talking so that they have a better signal, and I forgot to turn it off, so I've just been chatting away to nobody but myself. Mercury is retrograde, boys and girls. So thank you, Sierra. We are going to move on now to more callers on the switchboard, and then we'll be going back to the chat room. So we're going to talk to Ralph next. Just a second, Ralph. Let me get your mic open. Okay,
hello.
Ralph, you're on the air. Hello.
Hi, how you doing?
We're doing great.
Phenomenal show. Good. Listen, I have a quick question. Hold on a second. I got two phones on and I'm trying to turn one down. Dr. Carmen.
Yes.
It's phenomenal that you've been able to spend so much time at the pyramids themselves. But I was wondering, one thing you said earlier about not being able to, that most of us will not be able to raise our, I think you were saying raise our cells where we experience more than one layer past the first chakra, so forth. And I'm kind of paraphrasing. I'm not quite sure I understood what you were saying, but most people will not be able to do that. And I was just wondering if you thought that it was kind of absolutely necessary that we have the kind of experience that you've had at the pyramids themselves in order to actually experience the upper levels of experiences with our or higher selves, I guess you may say. Is it possible to do that without having to go there?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. There's a lot of people who experience many things without going to the pyramids, but I'm the one who's hooked on Egypt. It doesn't mean everybody else is. I mean, people could have had major experiences in other cultures, in other past lives at Machu Picchu or wherever. So, of course, it's not necessarily there. And I don't remember saying what you first said there, that you couldn't experience higher levels. To me, it activates me on the cellular level because I remember. Most of what I'm experiencing in Egypt is memory, and that's what keeps me going back. But also, as time goes on, I think there's more, I want to say, cellular surface or something to hear with, bigger ears to hear, and the more I go, the more I can put the story back together. But everybody's got their own memories, their own past lives where they achieved various things through monastic lives, through, you know, meditating or whatever. So it's going to be an individual thing. This just happens to be my story and my obsession, if you will, my passion.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that. That's kind of validating, I guess, for I've never been close to the pyramids and don't know if I'll ever be. I may, but I just want to know what kind of limitations I'll have if I'm not able to go. But it's good and refreshing to know that we can actually we have the power to have the same experience without having to go. Okay, thank you.
I mean, you could get the same experience at the top of a mountain or by putting your feet into a cold stream and wake everything up. So that's going to be your journey.
Well, thank you very much. Appreciate that.
Okay.
Thanks for calling, Ralph. It's always good to hear from you. We are going to move on now to talk to Joseph. Hello, Joseph. You're on the air.
Hello, Ariel. Good to hear your voice, sweetheart.
Always good to hear yours, too.
Thank you. Dr. Carmen, now these ladies are great friends of mine. We all met down in Albuquerque last summer at a conference. And I keep going back to Albuquerque. I've been down there about 12 times since then. I had to go down to the VA to have surgery and a whole bunch of stuff. So that's why I haven't been on the show quite a bit. But I'm here tonight, and I'm so looking forward to talking to Dr. Carmen. I didn't get to talk to you when you were on before, and I heard the program later, but it's sort of hard to call in. I called, but no one answered. Anyway, Dr. Carmen, it's inevitable. We're going to meet at some point because you and I have so much in common. I'm an opera singer. My favorite opera is Carmen, and I've sung Don Jose about 35 times. So right there, we've got that connection. I hope you like opera. If you don't tell me.
I was named after her.
Were you really?
Yeah.
Wow.
My father's favorite opera for sure.
Then you're a feisty lady, is all I can say.
That's right.
Yeah. I was in Egypt in 1988. I went with a group of Reiki teachers. There were about 40 of us there on the trip. And we had an extraordinary woman who led us. And we were met by an extraordinary man who I believe you know. His name was Champ, or Champion.
Champion, sure, I know him.
Yeah, and Champion was our guide around the plateau. We were taken into all of the temples up and down the Nile, and I received initiations in all of them, returning to the Great Pyramid, and Champ led us in and helped me into the sarcophagus, where I was surrounded by 40 people chanting, and I relived going through the mystery schools for 11 previous times, which I had not survived, and this time I did survive. So the trip was very, very important in my Egyptian lineage, certainly. So, I had dinner in Champ's home. He was very generous, very kind. excuse me. So I just wanted to share that with you because I heard you on an interview. I don't know if it was Coast to Coast or William Henry or somebody, and I called Lavendar and I said, you've got to have this woman on. She's amazing. And the next thing I knew, you were on the show. So I'm glad to have made that connection too.
Well, thanks for that. Wow. Champion was a very special person.
He certainly
Indeed.
Was.
Definitely.
Yeah.
He's in the Guinness
definitely.
Book of World Records for running up the pyramid in 4 minutes and down in three.
Oh,
that's
my
why
gosh.
They call him the champion. His real name was Hafnawi Syed.
Ah. Well, I took a picture of him, and you can't even see him. The energy is so amazing. He's just hiding behind this huge clump of energy. So he was extraordinary. Egypt.
On this trip, I met his grandson and his namesake. Well, I'd already known his grandson from the time he was 7 years old. I knew him.
Yeah.
And now he's a man, so that was kind of fun.
Well, I was there in 1988. He could have done a lot of growing up in that period of time. Anyway, it's wonderful to finally get to speak to you, and I'm sure at some point we'll get a chance to talk, because there's so many things I'd like to ask you, but I just wanted to share those things with you, and tell all the ladies, hello. I haven't been on in several weeks, but I'm missing a rehearsal tonight for an opera, but that's okay. It's worth it.
Well, we're so
glad. Well, thanks so much for sharing.
Oh, you're so welcome, and thank all of you for all that you do and for being here at this time. It's a very exciting time to be here on Earth, that's for sure.
I will have to agree with that. Okay, Joseph, thank you so much. It's good to hear you again.
Thank you, Ariel.
Okay.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay. Well, we are going to go back to the chat room and see if Purple Sage has any more questions for Dr. Carmen.
Well, of course
Hello.
I do. but first I would like to do a shout-out to Joseph and Ralph and say I miss talking to you guys. Sending love. Dr. Carmen, what are your thoughts about whether or not Isis was actually embodied as a human in physical form, or was she purely archetypal and or other in relation to Sirius Isis and the relationship between Sirius Isis and Orion?
Okay. It's funny because no one ever asked me that until recently, and it seems in the past little while everybody's asking me that. So I think that's interesting. I'm inclined to think that she was a real person and that she also was associated with Sirius, but many of us are Sirian and that we are starseed from there. Osiris, the word Sirius is right in his name, and I think we were able to move between these planetary systems, particularly as we were densifying in order to be able to handle having an Earth incarnation. And so I think we probably went, you know, from the Pleiades to Venus to Earth or various different densifications in order to tolerate being here. So it's possible that Osiris also was able to be in the Sirian planetary system, even though he's related to Orion. Now, we're never going to be able to measure that or know that other than intuitively. And I guess there's a part of me that thinks it may not matter if we know all of the details of that. We can still access the archetypal energy and humanize it, which is what we're doing anyway. So I like to think that Isis walked around and was here with us.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. had you personally been in contact with the artifacts found in Egypt that resembled the Baghdad Battery, and what are your thoughts on them?
For sure, that I have not seen them personally that I can recall, though it does seem very familiar to me. They're on the walls, on the frescoes, and I've seen those. But in terms of the actual clay jars, something's ringing a bell inside me. I think I may have seen them in a museum outside of Egypt. It makes sense, though, that they would take some kind of a vinegar or some kind of a fermented substance and be able to create a mild charge. But there was lots of that sort of thing that was going on in Egypt, and so I think it's very valid. And something that's kind of slipped into the background, but it's entirely viable and scientific.
Oh, I think so, too. This one, I don't know if you want to answer or not, and it could take a little time. You remember a lifetime, or maybe more than one lifetime, in Atlantis. Can you tell us about it?
I do remember a lifetime in Atlantis. What I remember is that there was an argument going on between the masculine and the feminine, actually, then, too, when they were pushing the crystals and wanted to overcharge them. And there was a period of time, of, as I recall, about 50 years, where there was a group of us that knew that the crystal was going to get overcharged, and that it was dangerous, and that we couldn't keep pushing things. And I think that in some ways we're in a similar situation where we can't keep pushing the economic system, we can't keep pushing polluting the planet. And there's groups of us that are alarmed by this sort of thing, and then there's groups of people that are just parading through and pushing it anyway. And so I think that there were evacuation committees that were put together, and that's part of how there ended up being pyramids all over the world. And that the Atlantean energy was brought there, and that it actually happened. And I remember actually in that incarnation that we were practicing being able to breathe underwater because we could see what was going to happen. And I've had, you know, many vivid, vivid recalls of, you know, the whole earthquake coming and tumbling into the water and, you know, spacing out into different dimensions and stuff. So that's very, very real to me.
That's interesting. One more question, and it's about the 22 goddesses whose higher selves were angels, which is really something cool to think about. Can you tell us how this information was received by you and the effect that it had on you when you were first introduced to it?
I actually think that it's past life recall from Egypt and a combination perhaps of other lives where this knowledge was known. I think it is concrete knowledge that was hidden. I think that tarot, numerology, and astrology were ancient Egyptian arts that were then driven underground when they became less popular and the powers that be didn't want people to know about this stuff. So I think that I was well aware of it all in another incarnation, and that it spirit definitely directed me to put this material together. And it was a long time ago, and I spent a lot of time researching, and then it was given to me that there were templates and that I should be putting it together as a system. And I remember once I had all the templates together, I had these charts that went with each one of them with the virtues and the astrological configuration. And once the whole system fit together, I remember thinking that, you know, either I was going to see it through right to the bookshelf in the bookstore or I was going to give up right then and there. And it was a huge commitment with lots and lots of roadblocks. And like I said before, it was very much ahead of its time. But it's kind of how spirit's been dragging me around forever. So I guess I kind of just chalk it up to what I'm supposed to be doing.
Oh, well, you're doing a great job, lady. Thank you.
Okay. Well, thanks, Purple Sage. And we are going to check in with Sierra here, and we'll try to come back to the chat room one more time. Thanks
sure.
so much, Purple Sage.
Uh-huh.
Bye-bye.
Mm-hmm.
Sierra.
Hello.
I know you're there. Sarah, do you have any questions, observations, or comments?
Well, it's pretty interesting, Dr. Carmen, when you were talking about that crystal that showed up. I'm just a huge crystal lover, and I had this question of, you know, I was asking the crystal, where did it go? So I've got, you know, an experience to share with you that I had after you spoke about the crystal, but then I also wanted to ask you before that, do you feel as though you absorb that crystalline energy into your physical body?
Yes, certainly. I mean, it was. I don't think that's where it ended up going. I think it popped back to where it came from. But I'm open for ideas. I mean, I didn't feel it fall off or anything or leave or become lighter on my forehead. So I'm not sure what to make of that. But I have had things manifest before and then disappear. And I've always assumed that they literally went back where they came from.
Okay. I was actually asking the crystal where it went, and I went into a meditation. And I don't know if we'd probably have to do this off air, but I had this experience where I was taken into a chamber as if it was an initiation process there in Egypt. And I couldn't tell you which one because I was only on the inside. I'm not very familiar. And it was almost as if I had been downloaded by something like an Akashic record of your lifetime and a whole bunch of other things that were happening and that you may or may not have experienced whenever you put that crystal on your forehead. It was pretty intense. and I could hear everybody talking in the background. It was like I was bi-located, but it was really extraordinary. It was a feeling of being lifted up and then taken through gates and portals, and then as if it was just an enormous download, and it all came through wanting to connect with this crystalline energy, because I'm a huge worker of work with crystals, crystal beings and different things like that. I was just, it got me going on the crystal thing. So when I was trying to actually locate that crystalline energy that was there working with you, I was bi-located into a bunch of different areas, and it was really an extraordinary experience.
Sounds familiar.
It's almost like somebody was flipping a deck of cards, and I retained all of it at the same time, but it's as if I felt like I was experiencing what it may be. I don't know, I might be stepping out of bounds here, but I was specifically connecting with that crystalline energy that was with you, and I felt like I might have gone on the same trip that you went on when you were there. It's pretty interesting.
Sounds great to me. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Sierra. That's incredible. We have a couple more callers on the switchboard. If you have anything else to add, Sierra, or not, we'll move on.
Well, I just wanted to say thank you for the work that you're doing over there, and Dr. Carmen, and I just so appreciate having you here and listening to your experiences and being able to connect with someone else who's had, experiences in past life through, the Egypt bloodline, I guess I'd call it. So thank you. I appreciate having you here, and thank you for all the knowledge you continue to spread to everyone.
Thank you.
Thanks, Sierra. We are going to pick up another call from the switchboard, and I don't see a name, but I do see this. I think it's a Skype name, Excel. Excel, you are on the air.
Hi, this is Art.
Hello, Art.
I just lost the chat room here.
Oh.
Okay,
did you have a question for Dr. Carmen?
Yes, I just recently did a little bit of a study on pyramids and that, and there's one thing I wanted to know if you heard anything about this. Like, there's a lot of evidence that the ancient Egyptians used electricity, because there's no soot in the pyramids, and it would be impossible to walk around inside the pyramids without light. And also some of the they're showing like lamp, them holding like lamps and the hieroglyphics and all that. And I'm guessing like what the king's chamber is like one third of the way up within the pyramid, and the sarcophagus in there. There's never been any evidence of anybody actually being buried in there, or mummified, or in any pyramid. There's never been any signs of any the pyramids being used as tombs or anything. But so one thing that I found interesting that I saw is there's like a theory that because of the so-called sarcophagus in the king's chamber, if you measure it, it's pretty much about the same measurements as what the Bible says of the Ark of the Covenant. The theory is that the Ark of the Covenant was the main conduit of the main electrical power of Egypt at that time, and the main reason why the Pharaoh chased after Moses was because he had pretty much stolen their main power supply. Have you heard anything like that?
Well, it's not so much hearing it. I mean, as many people talk about many things, but connecting into the energy, it's my conviction that the Ark of the Covenant, or a device like it, I don't think it was the only one, would have been charged inside the Queen's Chamber, not the King's Chamber.
Mm-hmm.
And that likely when it left Egypt, it was fully charged, and then it became less, you know, like a battery that doesn't work anymore. Interestingly, if you take batteries inside the Great Pyramid, they charge up again by themselves, passively. But they could have still honored what the Ark of the Covenant had represented, even though it became dormant because it wasn't able to hold that charge without the charging energies, I suppose, of the Great Pyramid. So, yes, I think that there was a form of electricity that was passive, not combustible energy, but an implosion energy. And Chris Dunn and Hakeem talked about that a lot. There are images that look like light bulbs inside the crypts at Dendera. And, yes, of course, they had to have some kind of light. I mean, there was, you know, there's so many places in Egypt that are dark, and they've got artificial light in them now. And William Henry will talk about all these devices that were somehow propelling them into other states of consciousness. There's all kinds of things about teleportation, and they were using the transmutation of the atom. They had a completely different system than we do that was far more sophisticated and non-polluting. So, yes, but I don't think that the Ark of the Covenant was kept inside the sarcophagus. You're right that there's no evidence that any burials were found inside the Great Pyramid ever. Or any pyramid. That's true.
Okay, thank you.
Well, thanks so much, Art. Thanks for calling in.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.
Okay, I'm trying to get this clicker thing to work here. All right. Lavendar, I know you're still with us. I need to look through the switchboard for more people with questions for Dr. Carmen. So can you step in here, Lavendar?
Absolutely. Well, Carmen, do you have any schedules that we need to know about? Are you doing any seminars or conferences or anything that's coming up where you can tell us where you're going to be?
Actually, I don't really speak at conferences anymore. I prefer to do things that are archived and recorded like this, though I did agree to go to Megalithomania in South Africa at the end of March. I do have projects that are, doing more television production and working with this sort of thing, and I'm in the middle of two books right now. So, nope, I don't think you're going to hear me talking unless you hear me on the radio or on internet.
Okay, great. Well, we certainly do, you know, want you to come back and speak with us later. And do you have any information about Athena being somehow connected to the Egyptian culture, or is that just Greece?
I typically have thought of her as a Greek goddess, though I know that you've mentioned the Athena energies. Again, she's been somebody that has had worn many hats and been seen in many ways. I tend to leave her in the Greek Parthenon. What do you have to say about her, though?
Well, I have a feeling that somehow the Egyptian culture represents some of the energies and some of the things that she did in Greece. And
I was just curious
about what you thought.
Oh, yeah, that's
okay,
for sure.
Okay, back to you, Ariel. Do you have anybody else on the switchboard?
Dr. Carmen was answering that. Hang on. Go ahead, Dr. Carmen.
Well, I do think that the Egyptian influence, like if you ended up in Greece for sure, like the Mediterranean basin is also a unified field, and if you were to leave on a raft from Alexandria, you'd bump into Crete and the other Greek islands. So I do think that definitely the Egyptian influence was all over Greece, and the temples of Isis were something that that soothed the populace. And so even in the Christian era, they continued to have temples of Isis all over the Mediterranean basin. And I think that's highly significant. And so parts of the Egyptian cosmology were passed down. And so that eventually ended up in the goddesses, the goddess-centered sites, the matriarchal goddess-centered sites in Greece, definitely.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Carmen, just curious, what is the time span between the Egyptian pyramid building era and the Greek heyday.
Well, no one's ever going to conclude on that, in that they try to say that the pyramid age was 2450 BC, and that's impossible. And I'm doing lots of research for this book that I'm writing now, and even the people that decided on the dynasties are spanning about 3,000 years of difference in terms of what Manetho said and what Petrie agreed on. So all of that is completely distorted, and I think the pyramid age was, you know, 42,000 BC, like a long, long, long time ago. And again, we're never going to be able to, you know, concretize that or find out exactly who built it and when. And then the Greek time, well, again, I mean, we want to kind of squish it into something that we could, you know, put in a textbook at school kind of thing, and it doesn't really fit. So the Greek time was, of course, B.C., but closer to, I don't even know how to answer that. I mean, I think that a lot of these archetypal energies are floating around in no time. So I just feel uncomfortable when I'm asked to put a date on it, because I don't think it's the dates that they told us.
Where I was going with that is because you know, Lavendar has told us that, you know, the Egyptian era was a Pleiadian project and a Pleiadian experiment, as was Greece. So it's kind of like getting the thread where there could be a lot of the same players in a different show.
Okay, but that's like us. We're the same players in a different show now.
Right, exactly.
You know, and it's been said that a lot of the Atlanteans came back in Egypt and then came back now. And I think that that's the company that we're in right at this moment. But perhaps it was a different play in a different season, but still the same entities, which is why
exactly.
Anubis would have to come and say, "You're dead." And you go, "Oh, really? I feel the same." So this whole thing is largely misunderstood by our collective unconscious, because we don't understand the whole, or we don't embrace the idea of the part of ourselves that doesn't die. So it could have been maybe not concurrent, but sequential.
Right. Right. Well, we have about 10 minutes left here. I am going to check in with the chat room one more time. But if anybody that is listening on the switchboard wishes to come on the air, you need to press 1 so that we know that you would like to talk rather than just be listening. So having said that, we're going to check in one last time with Purple Sage. Hang on, Purple Sage, I got to find you on the switchboard. Okay, we got you on the air, Purple Sage.
Hello. Well, first of all, Dr. Carmen, our starseed group takes supplements of silica to ward off the effects of the electromagnetic emissions. Because silica is a form of quartz crystals, I'm wondering what your thoughts are on this.
I definitely think we need to be protecting ourselves in one way or another from the electrostatic energies. There's also the electromagnetic fields, but I always think of the good stuff in Egypt as magnetic. I tend to not ingest a lot of that stuff. I tend not to take vitamins and that sort of thing because I think I can be generating things inside myself, but that's just me personally. But definitely we need to be thinking about what our world does to pollute the subtle energies. And I've had occasion to be in the Amazon where there's no electricity and, you know, for miles and miles around, and I just wanted to stay because really there's so many interference patterns that pound on us, literally. And electricity is operating at 60 hertz, and the energy field of the Earth itself when the pyramids were being built was at 8 hertz. And so we're being bombarded all the time, and anything we can do to protect ourselves that fits for each individual is extremely important.
Right.
Well said.
Right.
Well said.
Yeah. And then I would just like to make a comment about how nice it is to have Hakim's son, Yosef, take over for him, because Yosef has the great ability to speak so eloquently, and that's what we need.
Yeah.
And that would be it.
Okay.
Thank you, Dr. Carmen.
Thanks, Purple Sage. Okay. Well, anybody else? Oh, okay, we do have another caller on the switchboard now. Remember, you have to press 1 so that we know you want to come on the air. We are going to, well, I don't know exactly what your name is, but let's call you Baroque. You're on the air.
Hello, can you hear me?
Uh-huh.
Oh, wonderful. This is Jeremy. Ariel, thank you for my stage 1 reading. And Lavendar, I'll talk to you Friday. This is very exciting. And I have a question for both, maybe if Carmen and Lavendar want to talk together a little bit about the use of sexual energy in the Atlantean and then Egyptian traditions. I've read places where they were very interested, of course, in understanding gendered experience as multiple, multidimensional, and that there were initiations in which different genders or combinations of genders and experiences were invoked. So I didn't know whether on a cosmic or galactic level, there is some sort of way of helping starseed and interested earthlings understand the mixture and the combination of energies that may have had a lineage from Atlantis into Egypt.
That's quite the question.
I know. I'm an academic too, Dr. Carmen. I do work on Baroque opera, and imagine how Pleiadian and esoteric and all that stuff is.
Right. Now, that's something that, you know, I didn't really think a lot about in the early days of my research, and over time it's been creeping in with greater clarity. There's evidence of it everywhere, but we haven't been really looking for it or knowing how to recognize it. Now, one thing that's clear to me is that the Temple of Isis was where sex magic was practiced, and when you see bands around the upper arms of the initiates, that was a signal that they were trained in sex magic. But that just didn't mean, you know, for pleasure. That meant that they were somehow, somehow the feminine was raised, was trained in one location and the masculine was trained in another location. And when they came together to use tantric energy, it was very much purposeful, and it was very much about generating a certain amount of energy, not for personal pleasure and ego, but for the collective. And so you see, like, there's things that, of course, like, you don't notice. There's so much in Egypt that you can't take it all in at the same time. But there is a showcase in the Egyptian Museum that I've stood there and I've watched people just, you know, kind of glance at it and walk by. But it's all these malachite, lapis lazuli and turquoise dildos. And then there is an artifact that comes from the King Tut exhibit that is a silk condom. And it goes on from there, where you see various body parts. Of course, men had an erect phallus, and that's, you know, the Christians went crazy chopping all that off and defacing it all. And the women were bare-breasted, and then you see the blue lotus when they're in their dancing parties and they're wearing chiffon, and there was this incredible sensual component. Now, there's been some experiments done. There's a video series called Sacred Weeds, Blue Lily, and it's talking about the effects of blue lotus. When you see the dancing maidens would actually wear them on their third eye, and then you often see blue lotus with the stem wrapped around a wine jar. And so what they did is they took these fresh flowers and they put them into wine overnight, and then they had people who would sign their lives away so they wouldn't come back on them and try it. And the effect of it, and then they ate the flowers after they came down, but the effect of it was very subtle. Very centering, very sensuous, and very alert at the same time, and very mild, and then it would just wear off and they'd go to sleep. So I'm thinking that's a pretty good thing. Now, we've got this whole thou shalt not do drugs culture, and the Egyptians were busy having a really, really good time.
Absolutely. You know, Dr. Carmen, I want to thank you. That actually brought some interesting memories to mind.
Yes, exactly.
Wow, yeah.
And I remember, too.
Oh,
you know, and so
I'm
there have been
it's
people
very
who
sacred,
have...
It's very sacred,
Blue Lotus
beautiful
is
thing.
Actually almost extinct. And there have been people who have dried some of the petals and, you know, want to, whatever they want to do with it, smoke it or put it in wine or whatever. And I'm like, no. The flowers have to be fresh. And, well, you know, if they're dried, the properties are probably don't give me that. Don't talk to me about that. The flowers have to be fresh. And then, you know, somebody says, well, I think they put it into white wine. And I'm like, no, I'm pretty sure they put it into red wine. And I'm like, who's talking? Who knows? That, you know, but it's my bossy memory talking again.
yeah, because I guess my interest is that, and I mean, I am very personally interested in sacred sexuality. Our bodies are beautiful cosmic temples, and when people start realizing how much joy and power can be channeled from the higher dimensions, it's just kind of incredible. And somehow I felt like sort of stuck in some of my own personal esoteric studies. It's like, there is something that happened in Egypt, and it was not crazy like the Dionysian party culture we have now, in which that we had beautiful energy exchanges, beautiful cosmic energy exchanges. So that was the nature of my question.
Absolutely. But what they also understood is that nothing could happen without the balance.
Mm-hmm.
And nothing was about the ego. It was about the spiritual energies. And somehow we debased it all and corrupted it somehow. And
mm-hmm.
I'm pretty sure you remember, too.
Oh, my gosh. Mm-hmm. Thank
Isn't
you. Thank you so much. Oh, my gosh. I'm telling you. It's wonderful. Thank you so much, Dr. Carmen. And thank you for helping me remember.
And thanks for calling in, Jeremy.
Thank you so much, Ariel. Thanks, everyone.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, Dr. Carmen, you just have such a broad amount of broad spectrum of information, research, and you know, I feel like we really get the truth, you know, and the real deal when you come on the show, and it has just been such a pleasure. We are just about out of time, so just want to take the last couple minutes that we have and have Lavendar Sierra come back on and bid you farewell. We will say once again that Dr. Carmen's website is pyramidcode.com, and you can upcoming books that you will be having will be available. We'll know about it when you release them, when you finish them. Would we know about that by looking at that site?
Oh, it'll be announced. My writing deadline is January 15th, and then we go through the editing process. The plan for Aliens in Ancient Egypt, Close Encounters, and Secrets of the Nile Civilization is due to be printed by May and on the bookshelves by June. The other book I'm co-writing with William Henry, and it will be a video book, and we'll be announcing that privately. We've decided not to go through publishers, even though we've been offered that, so that we can make it more multidimensional and multimedia. And so, yeah, those will be notified. It takes a while to process all of this, but they'll be out next year for sure.
Well, you just make sure that you let us know, and we'll be following and have you back on. And remind everybody that 12-12-12, you're going back to Egypt. And
the schedule is posted, and the registration form is there.
Okay.
And then what that does is it puts me in touch with you, and then we can deal with, I mean, people have various preferences for how they want to pay for it and stuff, and so then I'll just start dialoguing with you about, you know, how you want to do it. So, but that's something that people can do. There's no commitment when you register other than the fact that you're then on the list. And so some people want to just make sure that they get in there, and if you need a roommate, then we can find you one and that sort of thing. So the registration's now open for the 12-12 group. There may be a few adjustments to the program because I just got back and somebody said they wanted
right.
Philip Coppins and Kathleen McGowan want to come and they want to be at Mena House. So I'm probably going to change that just for them.
Okay.
If I can get a suitable price for it because Mena House tends to be a lot more expensive. But I was on the 12-12
right.
trip when Pluto went from Scorpio into Sagittarius in 12-12 and we stayed at Mena House and I'm thinking that's fitting.
It sounds great. Well, we have just 30 seconds left, so from all of us here at Starseed Radio Academy, Dr. Carmen Bolter, thank you so much for sharing your time with us. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you very much for having me.
Oh, you're so welcome. Join us next week, same time, same place. Everyone, thank you for listening. Bye-bye.
Good night.
You've been listening to Starseed Radio Academy. Visit our website at www.starseedhotline.com.